All right, today we're doing Genesis 42, 43, where Joseph meets his brothers. And this is a meeting that he doesn't anticipate, and they certainly don't anticipate. What I wanted you to do as you read through this, and hopefully as you look through this, you notice how Joseph treats his brothers, There's reasons he's doing what he does. And if you read this carefully, you probably picked up one or two of them. Well, we're going to move away now from the discussion. I'm going to go into the narrative and explain it. And don't forget, we get so focused on Joseph, and it's natural. The way Moses has written this, we get focused on Joseph. But Moses drops these hints through the narrative that this really is about Jacob. Remember, this whole narrative starts with the history of Jacob and his family, and Joseph is part of that story. And what's so critical about this story is it's got to be carried along the way it is because of something that God said to Abraham back in Genesis 15. And this is something that must take place. They must end up in Egypt for 400 years, right? Genesis 15 is part of the Abrahamic covenant. With that in mind, when you keep that in the background, when you come to this narrative, you begin to see that Joseph's major concern is about Jacob. That makes sense? When you see what he does and see what he says and see what information he's trying to get, is really his major concern about Jacob. So Joseph treats his brothers the way he does, not because he's angry, but he wants them to think he's angry. He wants to discover if Benjamin and Jacob are still alive and safe, because they're not with him. Why wouldn't they have come? That's got to be a big question on his mind. So that's why when he sees these 10 bow down, he knows that's not the fulfillment to either dream. He's not seeing the complete number here. Number two, he's got to determine their attitude about him and what they have done. Because he knows what they did to him. And so he wants to find out what their reaction is going to be when they find out who he is. And I'm sure that's in the back of his mind. He didn't act out of revenge. He's not vindictive. What he wants is to discover their hearts. Now, I want you to look at this. Go ahead. I think Ed making the point that he not only disguised himself the way he looks, but he disguises his behavior. He's not the way he normally would expect him to be. What I want you to do is look at this. Could Joseph have very well said that? Why do the brothers hate Joseph? Let's go back to the very beginning of the story. Why do they hate Joseph? He was favored by the father. And the next event that happened, he has a dream. In fact, he has two dreams. And he told him the dreams. What did that bring out in them?
Jealousy and hatred.
And so, what did they do to him?
Get rid of him.
Was that a sin, what they did?
Yeah.
Is there an excuse for that?
No.
Could you say, well, because he was a tattletale and he was vindictive and he was kind of a daddy's boy, that it really would excuse that? No. But do you think that was his motivation? No. You know who said this? Jesus. Yeah. Jesus said this. If you go to John 15 and look that up, you'll see that verse. What I've tried to stress here is that Joseph is a model for Jesus. Jesus came favored by the Father and spoke the truth. What did that elicit in the Pharisees? Jesus had kept his mouth shut, would he have ended up on a cross?
No.
If Joseph has kept his mouth shut, would he have ended up in a cistern and being sold to slavery into Egypt? No. If he had kept his mouth shut. But you know what's amazing? Is when Joseph comes to power, and he's at second only to Pharaoh, he's given a wife who's the daughter of the high priest of the temple of the sun. That's a very elevated position. He's married into royalty, essentially. He has two kids, and he names them Manasseh and Ephraim. If you can get this in your mind, Manasseh means forget. Ephraim means fruit. How is this like Jesus? Joseph is thinking like Jesus here. Manasseh, God has made me forget my trouble. Ephraim, I'm naming that because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Notice, trouble and suffering go together. Now, in Jesus, what do we have? This is true for all of us who are in Jesus. God forgets our sin and our trouble. He casts them away as far as the east is from the west. He casts them to the bottom of the sea, doesn't he? No disagreement on that, right? when Joseph names his child Manasseh, he says, I am forgetting. I'm consciously, because God has caused this change in my heart, I am not going to hold anything against these people who put me where I am, where I have been in trouble and in slavery for 13 years. I'm going to forget that. I'm not going to hold that against them. That's what that means. God does not hold any sin that we ever commit against us because it is paid for. But now in Jesus, not only do we have forgetting of our sin, but in Jesus we bear fruit in the midst of this life. You can be in the midst of suffering and still bear fruit for Jesus Christ. You cannot even feel good about yourself or about your circumstances and still bear fruit for Jesus. Ephraim, I'm telling you, I mean, I believe this in the heart of my heart, that Joseph stands as a model for Jesus Christ. He is a blessing to the world because he spoke. Who is Joseph blessing now that he's in the position he's in? How bad is this famine?
Worldwide.
This is a worldwide phenomenon. Everybody's suffering, and who's standing up as the one who has enough grain to feed the world? When we face trials and sufferings and problems in our lives, who do we go to? When we look at the world in chaos and in suffering and the things that go on around us, who do we go to for sustenance?
Jesus.
Yeah. So here we go. Let's go through the narrative. Let's get into this now. Here's famine, year one. This is just the beginning. You know, Joseph says, why are you just sitting there? Go buy some food, you know, because why, we're starving. So he sends them down there, and he gets there. Joseph recognizes them, but to them he's a foreigner. I mean, he doesn't look like the Joseph they knew. He doesn't act like the Joseph they knew. I think that's what Ed brought up is very important. Joseph remembered the dreams. And because he remembered the dreams and only sees 10, he knows there's a problem. And the problem could be, my little brother's dead. My father might be dead. These guys haven't said anything about who they are yet. So he looks at them and he goes, you're spies. Because he knows who they are. So he's going to shake them up a little bit. Well, they cry, no, 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 because they know spying is a death sentence. And that's the last thing they want. He doesn't want to give them much wiggle room. He wants to keep them off balance because he wants to see if they will lie. Because he would expect them to lie. If he would just ask them, is Jacob still alive? They would automatically know, how do you know our father? That would be, he'd be tipping his hand. So he can't ask him directly, so he uses a threat of death, and that's going to make him tell the truth, or so he thinks. And he is right, because they say no or not, and he says again, you're spies. Now they give him the information he wants. Now he's an intelligence gatherer, and they say, no, we're 12 children. One is with our father, the other one is gone, meaning he's gone, they think, probably dead. Now, Naomi brought out a good point. They've bought into this idea so well in deceiving their father that this kid is dead, they start believing their own lie. Now that they're down here, kind of out of their element, they're not so sure, so they just say he's gone. You know what his response to that is? You're spies. Whoa, they're not getting off the hook. It's getting worse. But what Joseph knows now is that his father and Benjamin are alive, so they claim. What does he have to have? Exactly, proof. So he's going to give a test, and the test is, you bring Benjamin down here. One of you go and bring him back. The rest of you, jail. So that's the first condition. Now, we know that changed. Because after 3 days in jail, Joseph says, look, guys, I fear God. Using the word Elohim, they would recognize that. Other Egyptians are going to have this same testimony, by the way. They're going to use the same God's name. But he says here, here's the condition. If you're honest men, as you say you are, that's how you answered my question, then let one of your brothers stay here in prison, not nine of you, but let one of you stay. The rest go and take grain back for your starving households. He's being gracious. He's realized he's got the information he needs. Now here's the test. Go bring him back. He says, bring your youngest brother to me so that I know two things. That your words can be verified, because words are cheap. I want to see some action. And that you may not die. Because, you know, if you don't do this, I'm going to have the one I keep, I'm going to have him killed. And then maybe, perhaps as well, I'll hunt the rest of you down, because I'm powerful enough to do that. This is not an empty threat. He wants them to see this as being very real. Now, Joseph also has a very clear testimony in Egypt about who he is and who he serves. Because remember what he said to Potiphar's wife when he ran away? She says, "Lie with me, lie with me, lie with me." He says, "No. Not only would it be a wicked thing to do toward my master, but it is a sin against the God I serve." So his testimony goes way back to when he's 17 years old. And he has a testimony in Egypt about the God he serves. They say right in front of him, "We're being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we wouldn't listen." So they had his life in the balance, and they wouldn't listen to him. Now, this is all coming flooding back. Not only for Joseph is this flooding back, but it's coming flooding back for them. And they, as they stand there remembering what they did, they're confessing their guilt. And they're confessing their guilt as something they really did. So this is the reality of guilt. You really did this crime. But this is not just the reality. This is the buried emotion of guilt. Because they're remembering this. They threw him in the cistern, and he's crying and begging, and they sit down and they eat their meal. And they remember that. We hurt him. We didn't care. We just wanted to get rid of him. We hated him. So we didn't care. They all confess their guilt. Notice what it says in the text is clearly, they all confess their guilt. What does Reuben do? And Reuben brings an accusation to the rest. He says, "This is your fault. I told you not to do that, and you did it anyway." He wants to get himself off the hook a little bit, but it's not going to work. And you know, when he hears what they say, he hears them admit what they did. He hears them admit that I was in that pit, I was crying out, they ignored me, and now they see it. They admit it. They confessed it. He cries. But once he's done crying, he takes Simeon and puts him in jail. He sends them on their way with a load of grain and a load of something else, a huge load of guilt. And they're weighed under it as they go on their way, and their guilt is so bad. When one of them finds money in his sack. And what's he do? He says this, "What is this that God has done to us?" There's the nature of their guilt. It is so bad that they think God is moving against them when they see money. They're suspicious of even God's blessing. They can't imagine anybody doing anything good for them. Guilty people, you'd think, "Well, I have guilt. I go to God and He can forgive me." Guilty people really run from God. Until God intervenes. Look at 42:35. "It came about as they were emptying their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father," this is when they're back home, "saw their bundles of money, they were dismayed." That means they were scared. That means they were terrified when they see this money, that all of the money is there. And Jacob sees all this money, and he doesn't know what's going on, but he knows one thing. He doesn't know what they've done. And he doesn't trust them, and he's not going to let them go back. He especially doesn't trust Reuben, because he refuses Reuben's offer out of hand. Reuben says, "Look, we'll go back down with Benjamin," because he says, "We got to go back down. I'll give you two of my sons. You can kill them." Jacob just denies him. He doesn't trust him. He says, "No, you're not going to go." And look what he says in 36. He says, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. And Simeon is no more. He goes off with you, and he's gone now. And you would take Benjamin? All these things are against me. All these things. These circumstances, and even, ultimately, the subtext here is even God is against me." He sees no way out. And he sees Benjamin now as his only true son. See that? I have no one left. He says, "I have no one left but Benjamin." Isn't that kind of an insult to these other guys that are standing there? So now we come in to famine year two. So a year goes by, all the grain they have, it's gone. So they're starving. And remember, how long is this famine going to be? 7 years. And how many years are left? And it says that the famine was severe in the land. Now that's talking about the land of Canaan. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And look what he says in 7. And he says, "You know, why did you treat me so badly? Why did you have to tell him about Benjamin?" They say in verse 7, "The man questioned us particularly about us and our relatives. And he said, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' So we answered his questions." How could we possibly know that he would say, "Bring your brother down"? How could we know that? We didn't know he was going to say that. I mean, Jacob is almost saying to him, why didn't you just keep your mouth shut? Why didn't you lie like you always do? So Judah steps up, says, you send the boy along with me so that we and you and your children may live and not die. Because if we don't do something, we're all going to die. So you're worried about Benjamin dying? Well, I'm going to solve your problem. We're all going to die if we don't go down and get some wheat. This is how dire the circumstances are. So he says, I'll go down, I'll take care of him. And he says, I myself will guarantee you his safety. There's a threefold proposition. I'll guarantee his safety. Hold me responsible. If I don't bring him back, I will bear the blame. Do with me what you will. Judah steps up and he offers himself in the place of Benjamin to bear the punishment if they should lose Benjamin. Now, what happened to Judah in the narrative, this long narrative, back in chapter 38, when he says to Tamar, she is righteous, I am not. That is the point where he sees what he is and who he is. He repents. The question there was, is his character really changed? Has this man really become different than he was before? Remember how callous he is? There's another mark of his repentance. He offers himself in Benjamin's place. He himself is like Jesus. In fact, who's going to come from his line? Jesus. Yeah. So look at 11 through 15. Their father said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry them down to the man as a present. A little balm, a little honey, aromatic gum, some myrrh, some nuts, and some almonds. You get an idea of really, they're in the midst of a famine and they still have quite a bit. This is the wealth of this family. This is a wealthy and somewhat powerful family. But he goes on to say, take double the money in your hand. Take back in your hand the money that was returned. You got to give that back because we don't know why it was there. Because I don't want to be in more trouble than we are. Perhaps it was simply a mistake. So then he says, take your brother, go and arise and return to the man. And look what he says in 14. This is the first time he's really given inkling that he's going to depend on God. May God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of that man. Mercy. I pray in God's name that he will be merciful to you and your other brother and to Benjamin. As for me, if I am bereaved at my children, I am bereaved. If you all die, you all die. I'm going to let you go. Because he sees the reality of what Judah had said. If you don't, we're going to die anyway. Notice also he does the same thing here that he did with Esau. What did he do with Esau when he met Esau? Remember coming back from Laban? This is Jacob coming back from Laban. What's he do with Esau when he's going to confront Esau?
Sent all the gifts.
Sent all the gifts. And that is called appeasement. Appeasement. That it's a result of having a guilty conscience or living in fear. If you are fearful and guilty, you will always be appeasing people. And of course, people approach God in a religious way by appeasing him. I know God hates me, but maybe if I do this, he'll love me now. But God says, I love you, I want you to serve me. You don't have to appease me. And they get down there, they get to the house, they're greeted by the master of the house. They're frightened. They're frightened because they're brought to Joseph's house, and here's what they think when they get brought there. We were brought here because of the silver that was put back in our sacks the first time. Meaning they saw this as a trap. He wants to attack us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. They're just simply, we brought our little brother down, the whole family's here, now they're just going to take us all. We have really messed up. That's what they're thinking. Moses tells us their thoughts. And so they go to the chief steward. They don't go to Joseph. Joseph's not around yet. They go to the steward of the household who has met them. And when they see the steward of the household, they get scared. And here's what they tell the steward of the household. We have also brought more silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks. And the steward said, no, it's all right. The steward's going, you know what? I think I know the answer. I think the answer is you don't have to be afraid of the money in your sack. Your God, and he goes on to say the God of your father, and he's using the word Elohim, he's given you your treasure in your sacks. I received your silver. In Hebrew it says, I collected your money. My books are in balance. I got paid, so the money that you found in your sacks, that came from God. They cannot comprehend that God would actually do that for them. Now, we know what they don't know is that Joseph, when he sent them on their way, he told other servants who were packing up the wheat. The steward of the household doesn't pack up wheat and pack animals. The steward of the household, he prepares the dinners. He receives the guests. He had the other servants, and you read carefully in the text, you see that he told them, put the money back in their sacks and send them on their way. This household steward is not involved in that. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't know. I don't know. He may not know what happened. All he knows is, my books are in balance. So don't worry about the money. You don't need to be afraid. I know you got a God that takes care of you because he's taken care of the guy that takes care of me all these years, and he's fine. So he's giving credit to their God, which they can't believe that God would really take care of them. Now, this is a testimony from an Egyptian. Now, finally, here's what happens. Finally, your servant and our father is still alive and well, and they bowed down low and paid him honor, all of them now. Here, there's all of them there. So all 12 boys are here now, and 11 are bowing down to him. And this is really bowing down to him as the absolute authority in this situation. And let's go. Let's look at 43:29, the end of this narrative. In 29, Joseph's come home. They bow down. He now, as he sees them bowing down, he lifts his eyes. He sees Benjamin, 29, his mother's son. He says, is this your youngest brother whom you spoke to me? And they said, yes. He said, may God, that's Elohim, be gracious to you, my son. Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother, and he sought out a place to weep. He entered his chamber, and he wept there. Then he washed his face, and he came out, and he controlled himself, and he says, serve the meal. So they served him by himself, as he is second only to Pharaoh. He's going to eat by himself. And them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him, that means along with him, because, and here's the important point here, the Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for it was loathsome or detestable or disgusting to the Egyptians to eat with Hebrews who are from Canaan who are shepherds. And here's some distinctions between Egyptians and other peoples. Egyptians shaved. They did not like long hair. They shaved all their body hair in some instances. They were very, very clean, fastidious about cleansing their hands and their dishes and their tableware. Hebrews are shepherds. They eat out in the fields. They eat with sheep. They're essentially kind of dirty. The Egyptians look down on people like this. Now they were seated before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth, and the men looked at one another in astonishment. These are the 12 brothers. Why are they looking so astonished? How did he know who to put first and second and third and fourth? He put them in the order of their birth. How does he know that? And then he took portions to them from his own table. So now he serves them from his table. He serves them. They've just bowed down to him and he serves them. That reminds me of somebody. But Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as any of theirs. So they feasted and they drank freely with him. That didn't seem that they cared. What it means here is they got drunk. They really drank up a storm. And it doesn't seem to be that they had any problem with the favoritism. But he showered on Benjamin lavish favoritism, because to give one guest a double portion would mark him as a guest of honor. He gave him 5 times. That's important. It's 5 times. And it's lavish favoritism. Why does he do this just for Benjamin? What's he testing? See if they'll get jealous of Benjamin. Yeah. And they don't seem to. How did Jesus test the Pharisees?
Miracles.
Yeah, and who did he do the miracles for?
People.
Just people. Just regular, dirty people who didn't shave, who didn't wash their dishes and their hands before they ate, who didn't keep all the law. And the people, who did they favor over the Pharisees? Jesus. Because Jesus favored them, they favored Jesus. And so what was the Pharisees' reaction? Hatred. So what you have here is Joseph really is very gracious and very generous. He had to find out what he had to find out to see if there had been a change in these brothers. There's grace and generosity, but there's not real trust. He's going to give them one more test. He wants them to enter into a relationship with him where they see that he has forgiven them, where they experience that forgiveness. That's what this next chapter is about. So when you go through and read this, what does Joseph's final test really reveal about his brothers? Bud, would you pray for us to close?